In the summer of 2002, when Afnan was around 13 years old, her parents signed her up for a summer camp a few hours north of where they lived in Raleigh, North Carolina.
And we've been doing these forever. Like, as far as I can remember, we've always done the summer camps. And this specific camp was going to be in West Virginia at Pipestem Resort State Park. And we've been there many times. And so it's a beautiful place. It's up in the mountains. For us kids, we loved it because it was a chance. Like, a lot of times it was the first time we get to be away from our parents. We would put up our own tents. And it would be
the camp was organized through her local mosque in Raleigh. And she told us that there was definitely a religious element to the camp. They'd pray five times a day together. But mostly, it was just like any regular summer camp. A bunch of outdoor activities.
Like, we did a lot of hiking, canoeing, kayaking, playing volleyball. It was just really fun. It was a fun way to like connect with nature and then connect with like your fellow American Muslim peers.
So she arrives with all her friends, all her camping gear in the middle of this beautiful countryside with no real towns around for miles, just this one big lake and miles of forest. And one of the first activities they had planned was to go canoeing.
So we went that afternoon, and I remember we came back, and I think we had just finished praying, like Asr prayer or something like that, and we were getting ready to like do some other activity. And like, no joke, like 10 black SUVs come rolling up into our campsite. And I just remember all these white men come running out of these cars. And I just remember being terrified because I remember 9/11, and how much hate there was against Muslims. So my first thought was, oh my God, these are like the KKK is coming to kill us. And I was terrified. And I remember all the little kids come running around me because like we were helping with the little kids and stuff like that. And I remember the man in charge of the camp, Brother Isham, came running. And they were just everywhere. Like these white men run everywhere. And he told them like, please calm down. We have children here, and they had guns. And he was like, what's happening? Like, can you explain to us? So what happened was, is that while we were canoeing, kayaking, we dropped a volleyball in the water, and we forgot about it. Like, we didn't know that we had dropped it. And the people kayaking around us reported us to the FBI. And so the FBI came and raided our camp, and accused us of trying to bomb the dam. I don't know why I'm so emotional, but just so frustrating to see that how like any small act you did was just automatically associated with terrorism. Like the people that we were camping.
Afnan told us that these FBI agents raided the camp, interrogated the camp leaders, and tested the volleyball. In case you didn't catch that, they thought that the volleyball might have been a bomb and that these kids were trying to bomb the dam.
And then once they were satisfied with what they said, they kind of just left us alone and went about their business and left in their black SUVs. I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget that moment. Something that will stick with me forever. And I think the little kids...
Afnan never went back to that campsite again. And that experience that she had as a 13-year-old kid at a summer camp was being experienced in different ways by Arab Americans across the United States in the months and years after 9/11. Every American can tell you that they can remember exactly where they were and what they were doing on 9/11/2001. For me, it was when I was in Lebanon in my village on the roof of my friend's house, actually, and I rushed home to watch the horrific scenes. I'll never forget that day. For Arab Americans, it became clear in the weeks and months and years after 9/11 that it would change the relationship they had with their country and their fellow citizens forever.
I don't want the mosque here.
Why don't you want the mosque?
Why? Because I don't want to go through the Constitution. I know what the Constitution says, but they are spitting in our face, the mosque people.
In the week after September 11, 645 incidents of bias and hate crimes were reported against Arabs and South Asians in the United States.
This is not about peaceful Islamic people. This is about extremist groups that are going to be here.
I mean, it was horrendous, right?
First of all, in the immediate days and weeks after 9/11, I mean, Muslims were just afraid to leave their homes.
Amani Jamal is the co-editor of the book Race and Arab Americans Before and After 9/11.
Because they feared retaliation, physical retaliation.
Do you know how hard it is walking out in the street like this? Do you know how hard it is going to work like this?
You mean now?
It's not even Islamophobia, it's beyond Islamophobia. It's hate of Muslims.
Mosques were being vandalized. Islamic schools in the U.S. had to be shut down because there was fears and concerns that children in the Islamic schools could not be protected because of just popular outrage.
I've been told that some fear to leave. Some don't want to go shopping for their families. Some don't want to go about their ordinary daily routines because by wearing cover, they're afraid they'll be intimidated. That should not and that will not stand in America.
But it wasn't just the public outrage. Despite what the president said publicly, almost immediately after 9/11, the U.S. government started a program of mass surveillance against its own citizens of Arab and Muslim descent. Ordinary citizens all over the country, like Afnan and my own brother, Rami, for example, were interrogated, arrested, or even had their homes raided.
So when 9/11 happened, it was much easier to say, okay, this is the consequence of tolerating these uncivilized peoples in our societies. And hence, it allowed for this massive response that has not been witnessed in terms of how citizens are treated in the West. Because they were Muslim, we could basically interrogate them. We could violate their civil and political liberties. We need to protect ourselves. We need to make sure that these...
For a lot of people, this felt unprecedented. But it wasn't. Invasive and even illegal surveillance programs against Arabs and Arab Americans have a long history in the United States, a history that started decades before the attacks on September 11. Almost 30 years earlier, the U.S. government created a surveillance program to spy on Arabs and Arab Americans in the United States. Its code name was Operation Boulder. Under the program, 13 federal agencies collected intelligence on more than 150,000 Arabs and Arab Americans. One of those Arab Americans was a man named Abdin Jabado.
I found out that they had conducted this from 67 to 1975, and that they had distributed information to 3 foreign governments and 17 federal agencies when they didn't have one bit of evidence that I was violating any law.
So he took the U.S. government to court and in the process revealed that they were illegally spying on their own citizens. I'm Dana Balutz and this is Kernan Cultures, stories from the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between.
More than is predictable, they've seen it happen.
And one story that always kind of captures my imagination.
The streets lost culture.
And you're listening to Kernan Cultures.
A quick note before we start. We use the terms Arab American and Muslim American interchangeably in some parts of this story, even though many Arabs in the U.S. aren't Muslim and most Muslims in the U.S. aren't Arab. This is just how the categories came to be conflated by U.S. intelligence agencies. Okay, here's Suzanne Gabbard, one of the producers of this story.
There are hundreds of stories tied up in Operation Boulder. Stories involving deportations, long detentions, and heavy surveillance. But our story today is about this man, Abdin Jabara.
I'm an attorney by profession, but I'm currently retired from that.
Today, he's well known for his legal and social support of Arabs in the U.S. But growing up in a small town in the 40s and 50s, he didn't have much interest in his Arab roots.
So can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and how you grew up in the States?
Yes, I can, because I think about it quite a bit. I had a very interesting and a very essentially happy childhood.
His family had been in the U.S. for more than 3 decades at this point. And so growing up in that small town in northern Michigan, he says he felt more American than anything else.
It's a very bucolic area with lots of lakes and rivers and hills, and my father was in the grocery business in this small town, and was a very integrated community. The town was a kind of a self-contained unit. It had its own newspaper, it had a bakery, it had, and people rarely went to any other places because we didn't need it. We had it there.
The small town life suited Abdin. He went to a small elementary school in town, and when he wasn't there, he spent his time playing with his siblings and neighbors.
My mother would never go to sleep until everybody was home at night. She'd fix us these huge meals of Arabic food, and we'd all climb in the back of this open truck that had a canopy on the top and head out to some lake or some park or something and have a picnic. We had such a loving family. All of this rather idyllic situation changed very drastically when I was 10 years old, as my father and I went to a neighboring city, actually a small city, to get groceries for our store, and we were involved in an accident in which he was killed and I was quite badly injured. And it took me several months before I recovered from that injury, after which I began working in this store, and I continued working in it. But during that time I was finishing school, I think partly because of the loss of my father and not really having had an opportunity to fully grieve his passing, I became much more intensely involved in his very strong attachment to his ethnic background.
Abdin started trying to learn everything he could about his father's Lebanese heritage and became more interested in issues facing the Arab community.
And in high school, I got involved in forensics competitions,
which were kind of like speech and debate competitions.
And I wrote an original essay that I used in this competition about the Palestine problem. That was my first introduction to it.
He also started learning Arabic, which he hadn't spoken a lot of growing up.
After which I thought I should go to the Middle East and maybe I could improve my spoken Arabic, and I went to Egypt.
He spent 6 months in Egypt and then traveled to Lebanon, first to Beirut, then to his parents' villages in the Bekaa Valley.
And met relatives there, including the uncle after who I was named, who was 107 years old when I saw him. And it was quite an experience. And I traveled from there to Damascus and Aleppo, where I caught the train, the Orient Express.
The Orient Express took him as far as London, and from there he traveled back to the U.S. and finished up at law school. But when that was done, he went straight back to live and work in Beirut, where he got a job at the Palestine Information Office. This was in the 1960s, so Beirut's heyday, and he quickly surrounded himself with a group of Arab intellectuals, journalists, and activists. One of them was Anan Ameri, a young journalist just starting her career.
I was living in Beirut, Lebanon, and working with the Palestine Research Center and have a side job as a freelance journalist.
One of her editors at the time gave her an assignment to interview Abdin for an article.
And he sounded interesting, so I went to do an interview with him. And he asked me out to dinner and then another dinner. And then a week later, we decided I was going to go to France. And we decided we meet there. And then one thing led to the other. I end up coming to the States to visit him. And we end up marrying. Came here in July and we got married in November. Very fast.
But in the mid-60s, as Abdin's work in Beirut started to dry up, he decided it was time to move back to the U.S. and start his own law practice.
Shortly after I opened it, the war in the Middle East, the 1967 war happened.
Israeli forces drive spearheads across the Sinai Peninsula, west to the Suez Canal, south to the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba, breaking the blockade, capturing the west bank of the Jordan River, and occupying the old city of Jerusalem.
They were all these things came kind of crashing down. And I was just totally in a state of shock because I had just been there. I had just lived in Lebanon and had traveled in Syria and in Palestine. And that war was a huge psychological blow. And it kind of reminded me of the way that I experienced my father's death that same kind of sense of loss.
At this point, Abdin wasn't sure what exactly he could do to help. So he began speaking with other people in the Arab American community in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And they all said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And someone suggested, well, we need to create an organization that will help get out accurate information about the Arabs and about the Palestinians, because the American people don't know.
The group that came together in those days eventually became the Association of Arab American University Graduates. It was one of the first national Arab American groups, and they began hosting annual conferences, bringing scholars like Edward Said to talk about imperialism in the Middle East.
But the main focus was on this new nascent resistance to Israel that was embodied in the Palestine Liberation Organization. That was ultimately what got me in trouble with the U.S. Intelligence Agency.
Around this time, the U.S. government had started surveilling Abdin. They were secretly recording the speeches he gave at those annual conferences, tracking his social activities, and tapping his phone. But it wasn't just him. This was part of a much broader intelligence program called COINTELPRO. Under it, the FBI were already monitoring and harassing black activists and leftist groups.
Socialism is the people. If you're afraid of socialism, you're afraid of yourself.
Groups like the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and the American Indian Movement.
We know they have our pictures, we know they're looking for us, we know they want us.
They saw them as pro-communist, anti-American.
The Communist Party of America is doing everything in its power to steal the minds and the souls and the hearts of our young people.
This was the 1950s and 60s, the darkest days of the Vietnam War. The Cold War loomed in the background of almost every American psyche. The civil rights movement was taking off, and the U.S. government was in a state of panic.
Tragically, our nation's leadership, while striving for peace, has adopted a course that makes real peace unlikely.
And they reacted by coming down hard on any dissenting group who they felt were a threat. Their methods, though, were often illegal. Assassination, spinning false narratives, arbitrary detainment. In 1969, they helped orchestrate the murder of the Black Panther Party's chairman, Fred Hampton. So in this context, in the early 1970s, the FBI officially added, quote, potential Arab saboteurs to the list of groups that they saw as a threat. And then...
This is an ITN newsflash from the Olympic Village in Munich, where early this morning, armed Palestinian guerrillas raided the sleeping quarters of the Israeli team.
The Black September attacks happened at the 1972 Munich Olympics.
The gunmen shot dead two Israelis and are now holding 20 athletes and six officials as hostages. The guerrillas are demanding the release of 250 Arabs.
And this is where Operation Boulder starts. After the Black September attacks, the Nixon administration ordered the creation of the program. In the words of one of its directors, it was set up to, quote, check records and help establish the identity and immigration status of any Arab or other suspicious person. Basically, it was trying to drive a wedge between less politically engaged Arab Americans and those with what the FBI saw as more radical pro-Palestine politics.
Unlike some of the earlier intelligence gathering after the 1967 war, for example, Operation Boulder wasn't secretive. The U.S. government put out press releases in the newspapers, which were written up in places like the New York Times and Newsweek. Headlines read things like, U.S. checks Arabs to block terror, or U.S. begins screening Arab residents and travelers for terrorists.
But for a lot of Arab Americans living through this period, Operation Boulder meant early morning home visits from the FBI, being questioned and interrogated on your college campus, having your private phone calls tapped, threats of deportations, visa denials, or any combination of the above.
Every Arabic surname person, regardless of their nationality, had to be cleared by the intelligence service in the United States before they could get a visa to come to the United States. Every single one of them.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, when you first found out that the government was surveilling you?
Well, we had a law firm in Detroit. We bought a house up outside of the downtown area. The law firm, the building was broken into, and I got some calls that were black bag calls, and I was sure that it was FBI.
Black bag call is a kind of spy slang to describe tactics like breaking and entering or electronic surveillance.
And then the other thing that happened, and I think I told you this over the phone, was one of my partners went to the bank and somebody that was working there called him over and showed him this list of names on this paper that were two or three Palestinian organizations and three or four individuals, and my name was on it.
When he asked around, nobody could tell Abdin why his name had shown up on that list. But he knew that this was a move right out of the FBI's playbook, to keep tabs on the bank accounts of the people they were spying on. So as a lawyer, his first instinct was to take legal action to figure out what was going on.
We knew we weren't violating any laws. We knew that we were doing what America says that we're entitled to do, which is to engage in political activity to petition for change.
I remember, like, he was very, very angry that the FBI will have the audacity to check his bank account, and he was determined to sue them.
This is Anana Mary again. She was married to Abdin at the time.
So when he come home and he say, oh, honey, you don't know what happened today. This bastard, I will get even with these bastards. They're going to, you know, look at my bank account. I'm going to sue them. I'm going to do this to them, and they can't. And like, he's like that kind of a person.
So Abdin called the American Civil Liberties Union, better known as ACLU, asking for help. And his case was assigned to a counterterrorism lawyer in Washington, D.C.
John Shattuck, I'm an attorney. And for 13 years, I was an attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union in the 1970s and early 1980s, during which time I represented Abdin Jabara.
With John Shattuck and the ACLU, Abdin put a case together to find out the scope and depth of this surveillance.
So we pieced together some information, and in 1973, we filed a lawsuit against the FBI, and then we added to that the NSA and other agencies who were involved in this surveillance.
Eventually, that lawsuit led to the discovery of much of the information that we know about Operation Boulder today.
I think within the first 4 or 5 months, I have a figure here, I think something like 13 or 14,000 people had been investigated. And then within the next year or so, sort of by the middle of 1974 or 75, probably over 100,000 people, including Arab Americans, not just visitors to the United States, but American citizens who were living here and fully authorized to be here and fully engaged in life of being an American, were captured by this surveillance.
So what does that tell you? What does that tell you about this vaunted democracy of ours that wants to say to the world that how it stands for individual rights? The fact of the matter is that when they feel threatened in any way, those rights go down the tube.
In an affidavit, Abdin said neighbors even started to notice people snooping around his house. Once, after his phone stopped working, a telephone repairman came out to inspect the lines near his house and noticed that they had actually been cut. Abdin said a neighbor later told him that they'd seen men in suits in the back of his house right around the time that the phone lines went out. It's creepy. One of the other things that they found in the case is that some of the information had come directly from groups whose goals countered Abdin's.
One of the major sources of information about Jabara, which led to the targeting of his case in the Operation Boulder, was a set of Zionist sources, as the judge says. I mean, I'll very specifically quote from his opinion. We have it right here. He says, included in the information regarding Jabara throughout is data which the FBI has received from Zionist sources.
One of those sources was the Jewish Defense League. Essentially what that means is this private organization was gathering information about other American citizens, and sharing it with U.S. intelligence and police departments.
And they had hired private investigators who went out and gathered information of speaking events, etc., and also got involved with various police departments around the United States to help gather information.
How did that feel, learning that?
Well, it was just kind of, I'll tell you very honestly, I mean, you know, of course it's both intimidating and a little bit kind of empowering in the sense that they think that you're doing something that really is making impact, you know?
But it was taking a toll on his family. It was one thing to know that their phones were being tapped, but then a lot of weird stuff started happening to them. They started to notice people following them. And then somebody, and they don't know who, broke into their home.
One thing was very unsettling to me is like a year and a half after we were married, somebody broke into our house and it looked like a robbery. And I told Abdin, I don't want to stay home. I'm very, very nervous.
Anand began avoiding the house entirely. She was studying English at a nearby university and would wait for Abdin at the college library until he was done with his own classes so they could head back together and she wouldn't be alone.
I said, drop me at the library and when you're ready to go home, I'm not staying home by myself.
Up until now, this all sounds like vignettes from a bad spy movie. The men in suits, the tapped telephone calls. But then, in March 1976...
Our neighbor called and he said, your house on fire. And initially, so just kids in a neighborhood, you know. And then rumors started among the community, oh, it must be because of your political activism. And that really scared. That's when I got scared.
They never got to the bottom of what caused the fire. There's no evidence that it was the FBI or any other intelligence agencies who were spying on them at the time. But still, their house burnt down. Over the next few months, though, they rebuilt it. And then they sold it as fast as they could.
And it took me a while to feel comfortable in our new house. But I never said to him, don't do this anymore. Ever, ever. I was very proud of him. But I didn't want to die in a fire either.
Which is very fair.
In 1979, after 6 years of pretrial evidence gathering, there was a decision by the trial court judge that Abdin's First Amendment rights had been violated. And the FBI had to present greater evidence of how and why he was surveilled. Abdin had won. Sort of.
And then that went to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals reversed the trial judge's decision and said two things, really. First, that it affirmed that this was indeed an intelligence investigation and that there was no evidence of criminal conduct and that this was really just intelligence gathering. But it basically said that an intelligence investigation of this kind was probably constitutional.
Despite the U-turn, the appeals court decision had a big impact on Abdin's case and Operation Boulder. It also had an impact on how this kind of intelligence gathering would happen in the future. The order still held that the FBI should stop investigating Abdin and that the records that they gathered on him should be destroyed. But it also established the idea that when governments are spying on people, they can't just cast a wide net and see what turns up. Intelligence gathering had to be more focused.
And second, that in general, some kind of a warrant procedure or a court order should be necessary in order to make this kind of surveillance constitutional. And that, in fact, is what led to what's known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was a federal statute enacted in the late 1970s. And, you know, today remains kind of the standard against which these kinds of surveillance activities are judged.
We can't say for sure how much Abdin's case influenced this. But in 1975, while the case was still ongoing, the entire Operation Boulder program was officially shut down. They said because it involved too much paperwork.
After the break, how surveillance of Arab Americans continued long after Operation Boulder was shut down. We'll be right back. When we left off, the U.S. government had officially shut down Operation Boulder. And although the program had ended, this kind of surveillance against Arabs and Arab American communities did not stop.
Well, let me tell you, it lessened. All right, it never really stops, but it lessens.
In the years after Operation Boulder, there were lots more incidents of government surveillance of Arab and Arab American communities. They just went under different code names. In the 1990s, there was Operation Vulgar Betrayal, in which U.S. agencies used similar tactics, intimidation, home visits, and electronic surveillance to harass the Arab and Muslim community in Chicago.
And then, of course, after 9/11, everything changed.
Well, I think the Operation Boulder was, in fact, something of a blueprint for what was put in place after 9/11.
So for me, Operation Boulder is one point in a much larger story that, you know, starts well before Operation Boulder and continues well after Operation Boulder began.
This is Associate Professor Nicole Nguyen, who studies the relationship between national security, war, and education at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
The 1970s, I think, is important in Operation Boulder in particular because it's sort of the consolidation of anti-immigrant, anti-activist, anti-Arab, and anti-Muslim policies and sentiments. But I think there's a lot of key features around Operation Boulder, both in terms of trying to regulate immigration and construct this sort of perceived external threat, Arab threat to the United States, and the criminalizing practices happening within the United States, and sort of every iteration since Operation Boulder.
You had the architecture of surveillance and identifying people based on nothing else but their identity and treat them as basically guilty.
Again, this is Amani Jamel, who we heard at the top of the episode.
Even if criminals are guilty in the U.S., they still have rights. But with the surveillance projects that start with Operation Boulder and throughout, not only are Muslims and Arabs treated as guilty, but basically guilty to the extent that they're not worthy of the civil and political protections that are ingrained in the Constitution.
The kind of overt racial and religious profiling that happened after 9/11 was criticized by Arab and Muslim communities, as well as groups like the ACLU. Because of that, some of the fundamental aspects of this type of surveillance began to change. For instance, instead of having agents on the ground following people, listening in on phone conversations like they did with Abdin in the 1970s, these days, informants would pose as community leaders, imams, for example, and report back to the FBI.
Now, it's not just law enforcement who is out to police you, to monitor you, to gather intelligence on you. It's also your teachers, your librarian, your therapist, your social worker, right? Everyone now becomes a potential node in this larger national security apparatus where, you know, people will report, I don't want to go to my therapist because I'm afraid they're going to report me to law enforcement, right? I'm afraid of what's going to happen to those notes. I'm afraid to check out books from the library. I'm afraid to say anything political in the classroom, right? So you start to erode these spaces that are supposed to give care to communities as they become these sites of surveillance.
But it's undeniable that some of the fundamental patterns that began with Operation Boulder are still around.
Yeah, there are a few really clear through lines. The first is that Arab and Muslim immigrants in particular, but Arab American and Muslim Americans as well, pose a national security threat to the United States that demands a sophisticated response that includes surveillance, that includes criminalization, that includes policing. I think a second through line would be that Arab and Muslim political organizing, whether domestic, in Palestine and elsewhere, is also a threat to the United States. And that needs to be monitored, surveyed, and repressed ultimately. And so, you know, part of what Operation Boulder was about sowing discord within Arab and Muslim communities. It was about fracturing communities.
And while U.S. government surveillance of Arab and Muslim Americans continues, if Abdin hadn't sued the U.S. government, we might never have known the extent of its discrimination against his community.
So in a sense, I think he's a hero of civil liberties in some ways, and I salute him for that, and I was very happy to represent him in that.
Abdin has continued to work against anti-Arab and Muslim bias by the U.S. government. Him and Anan ended up getting a divorce and have both since remarried, but they're still very close. He lives in New York City now and continues to mentor young Arab activists. One thing he said that stuck with us is that when he looks back on his work, he often wonders, what would my father think?
And I think back at him, and I just wonder what he would say about me today. You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure because there's... he'd think maybe I was maybe getting in too much trouble and that I shouldn't. But I don't know. I really don't know.
We came across a poem that you had written about your father. Would you mind reading that for us?
Do you have it there?
Yes.
I think I remember it all, but it's the best poem I've ever written.
It's beautiful.
Father, I know you came out of a long mountain, wide-thumbed, brimming with mustache, your shoulders stuck in a tight coat, pieces of bread in your pocket. Left like others in the Ottoman time, excited in a small boat. Behind you, a village of consequence, centuries of a pointed stick in the earth, and the face of an old woman, your mother, crying softly in a bad winter.
This episode was produced by Suzanne Gabbard and Will Thompson and edited by me, Dana Balut, and Alex Atak. Fact-checking by Dina Sabri. Additional support from Nadine Shakir and Zena Duwaidar. Sound design and mixing by Paul Alouf. Thank you to Afnan, Amani Jamal, Abdin Jabara, Anana Mary, John Shattuck, and Nicole Nguyen for speaking with us for this episode, and to the Bentley Historical Library for the use of their archives. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Thanks for listening. Take care. Stay safe.